And in this episode, Jack and I are talking to the general. fuck, I'll start again.
Oh, good.
We're not
good.
Talking to the Generalissimo.
We're talking to the Generalissimo himself.
that's actually a good one. All right. Hello, and welcome back to The Great Game. This is episode 26, in which we got to sit down with the Generalissimo himself, Kieran Sullivan from True North, to talk about The Generalissimo is Dead. It's a game that I've been living and breathing recently, as I will be bringing it to Sydney in just a couple of weeks from publishing this podcast. And so it was really great to chat with Kieran for the second time, as you'll hear in the episode, about the game. Before we kick on, though, I've been living and breathing The Generalissimo is Dead, but Jack, you have been living and breathing something else for quite a while now, and especially the last few months. Did you want to tell us about it?
Absolutely. So not mega game related, but I have been obsessing over my video game, my visual novel, The Thief, the Witch, the Toad, and the Mushroom. It is a spooky, mysterious, charming style of visual novel focused on all about folk tales and designed to look like an old book you've found with mysterious documents and things. That you can discover as you explore the pages. It'll be releasing on Steam and itch.io on the 23rd of March, so very soon now, probably about 2 weeks when this podcast goes live. So yeah, if you are interested, please do wishlist it, everyone. If you do end up playing it, drop me a review or a line. I'd love to know what you thought of it.
And you'll be doing a live launch of that in Brisbane, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. If anyone is around in Brisbane, any of our listeners, I will be doing a launch event on the 21st at Netherworld. You can find that event on Netherworld on Facebook, but it'll be on the 21st there in the bar at 7 o'clock.
Awesome. We will put a link to both the game and the launch event in the show notes, so do support Jack in that. I think you're right, it's not mega game related, but it is very mega game adjacent, and I think it's been proven from some of the conversations we've had in the past that a lot of the community are really into that kind of thing. So good luck with it, and thanks for sharing. Everyone go and like it and wishlist it. And Jack, also there's some big mega game news happening in Australia that is worth a shout out. Did you want to tell us about what's happening down in Melbourne?
Absolutely. So First Contact is the big upcoming game on the scene. So this will be the 205 player mega game that is all focused on First Contact with an alien threat. The tickets will go on sale officially for the public on the 18th of March. It's also kind of a celebration of 5 years since Melbourne Mega Games was officially started up. So that'll be absolutely lovely. I'm going down to Control, so you'll be able to say hi to me if you end up going there. But definitely bookmark it if you are keen, because that will be an absolutely huge one.
Yeah, do check it out. It's a milestone for games over here. You can hear all about First Contact in the podcast episodes we've done recently, and also over at the Mega Game Assembly from interviewing the guys at Very Large Huge Games. So do check it out. And just at a glance as well, we have to encourage you to go and have a look at the Mega Game Assembly calendar. We were having a squeeze before recording, and from the date of publishing this episode, there's 24 games happening in this half of the year all around the world. From God Emperor in Switzerland to Deep Haven in Louisville, America. So check out the calendar, find a game near you, share it around. It's the year of mega games, it seems. So with all that out of the way, thanks for tuning in. Hope you enjoy hearing about The Generalissimo is Dead. We had a great conversation with Kieran. And anyone who has a listen in the first couple of weeks of publishing this, if you're really interested, there's no more tickets left. But we'll be running in Sydney. Enjoy the episode. Well, Kieran, thank you for joining us a second time. As I've probably covered in the introduction, I will say again, this is not the first time we've had this conversation. we did run through every single detail once before, last year, technically, I think. And someone lost that recording, and here we are doing it again. So I do apologize, but thank you for joining us again. We were also going to have you on, Kieran, in another episode recently, which unfortunately you were unable to make, talking about publishing. So despite the fact that we've talked quite a bit recently, this is probably the first time people are hearing from you. So did you want to just give us a quick introduction, who you are, where you're from, how you came into the Mega Game world?
So I'm Kieran. I'm up in True North Mega Games in Scotland. I'm based in Dundee. Thanks for having me on. So I came into Mega Games, I think, with there's people thrown around terms for like what that like who this era is, but the people that came in from the Shut Up Sit Down video. Mm-hmm. So I saw Watch the Skies, and I was like, oh my god, what a fantastic blend of like role playing games and board games all into like a one big day experience, man. And I was immediately hooked, and I was like, so I went down to London to play in the first couple, and I was like, man, it's expensive to keep going to London, but god, I can't quit this. So I just went about creating my own games, because I was like, well, I could probably make this happen in Scotland. I happened to know a place that was like a pretty affordable venue. I did all my like napkin math, being like, could I afford to just lose all this money if nobody comes? And it was fine. Yeah, I was like, okay, let's try it. So I did the classic made a Watch the Skies, just a sort of general Watch the Skies, and it went really well. Everyone had a really good time, and then I was sort of bitten by the bug of like, oh, let's, what could we do to improve this? What could I do to think? So I just sort of went off down a rabbit hole of like, made my watch, the three Watch the Skies I ran in Dundee were all continuous. So they all like built off of each other's narrative, which the engine for Watch the Skies isn't really built for, particularly stuff like the tech. Tech tree is not really designed for the assumption that the previous game has happened, because you sort of, by the end of the first game, it'd be very rare that players haven't gotten to the moon, at the very least. And so by the end of the third game, the wheels had well and truly fallen off of the cart that we were running. And like, I tried to shake it up with like different aliens every time. I think for the second one, I introduced a faction of police aliens that were in charge of. They were angry at the first aliens for showing up in the first place, but also they were like, there's a bunch of arcane laws that the Universal Galactic Government requires you to follow, and the humans were like, there are a bunch of what now? And they were like, yeah, no, absolutely nobody uses nuclear weapons. And France was like, well, that's an opinion, and launched a nuke at their ship. So I did Watch the Skies, and then at the end of the third one, I was like, I'm exhausted, I couldn't possibly do that again. And so I ran a game, I ran Exterminator War with Jim Wallman, because I went down to Cambridge to help him run it, and he was looking for somewhere else to run it, because I think he wanted to get it like out a few times to sort of see how it goes outside of his original playgroup. And there were some brilliant moments in that one. There was like one player showed up with a dossier of briefings, which included plans A through G. And the plans were like folder, like little folders he could hand out to his teammates. And so he would just sort of turn to people and say, everyone, it's a plan B situation. If you could all turn to plan B in your notebooks, which was very funny.
Wow. Incredible.
The whole game was went a little wonky because we had a massive snowstorm that stopped all our players coming on our first date. We rescheduled, and we obviously lost a few players in that shuffle. But so we didn't have the enemy faction played. That was done by like GMing from the control players. But it was a fun day. And then after that, I decided to design my own mega game. My first like full design, which was Rebel Country, which is a sort of a Star Wars mega game. It was supposed to be Star Wars with the serial numbers filed off. As it got closer, it just became very blatantly Star Wars. But the idea was, it was kind of like a reimagining of the... So I'm from Northern Ireland. I grew up in Belfast. It was a reimagining of the Troubles in Northern Ireland, because I felt like the Star Wars has this sort of implied era of detente, which I think we've now seen in Andor, but we hadn't really seen when I wrote the game. But that's sort of, there's this sort of like implied era of detente where there is an imperial force governing people that don't necessarily want to be governed. And some people are in support of the imperial regime and some people are not in support of the imperial regime, but the imperial regime is not willing to engage in outright brutality in case they push more people over to that other side. And I feel like that's a very, it's a clumsy analog, but it's a close enough analog to the sort of challenges faced in the sort of the Troubles era. But equally, I didn't want to run a game seriously about the Troubles because I feel like that would have had very, very niche interest or appeal, particularly as I don't live in Northern Ireland anyway, so wouldn't even, not even a lot of people in Scotland have a particularly good knowledge of it. So yeah, I ran Rebel Country, and I think it was a great experience to design and run a game from scratch, but it was a learning experience. It was very, I learned a lot, and the big thing I learned was that I just made a game that was far too complicated. I just got really excited about lots of little mechanical details, and there was like, I think there was three or four phases to each team's part in the turn order, and each team had to act separately. Like the Rebels acted first, then the Imperials acted, or it might have been the other way around. And it was just, it was a nightmare. It was too much. And so, yeah, I took a lot of my learning from that. And yeah, that's when I went to writing the Generalissimo.
And that sounds like a serious jump from having now digested the Generalissimo is Dead very thoroughly. It's very mechanically tight, light, easy to understand. So it sounds like you took quite a lot of lessons from the Rebel Country. It was quite complex and crunchy.
Yeah, it's definitely, I think that was the biggest takeaway was, oh man, you don't need any of this. All this extra stuff, just throw that out.
So how many of those games were with True North Mega Games?
So technically all of those are pre-True North. I don't, Generalissimo is my first True North game. So I ran those games myself. I just called it Mega Games Dundee for the purposes of branding, but it wasn't like a network or anything. It was just me. And so I think we gathered enough players coming to those, and a few of us recognized, hey, we're from Scotland and like from Newcastle and the northern side of England. And we were like, man, and we were all sort of lamenting, it does sort of suck that we have to go all the way to at least Manchester, probably London. And the UK is like got really bizarrely weak public transport for like a tiny little region. Like anyone who comes from like Germany or I would imagine Australia, it's just shocked at how difficult it is to get from A to B in the UK. And so we can get to London really easily because the train goes up and down the country. But if you want to try to get anywhere in the middle, you basically add an overnight stay because the trains don't go at angles. It's very bizarre. So we decided to get together and run create True North. And since we've been running True North, we've run about four games a year on average. I think a couple of years we've done three, and obviously we had the gap at COVID. But yeah, so Generalissimo, I wrote it up to be my first True North game. We were going to run it in person, and then at the last second with COVID and all, I turned it into a possibly to be played digital mega game. And so I've now done it both digitally, like online and in person.
Fantastic. Well, I definitely want to ask you about the online version, but first I think just why don't you tell us the pitch for The Generalissimo is Dead. What's the game about? What inspired you to make it?
Yeah, so I was watching The Death of Stalin, and it's a great film, very funny. It hits this sort of like brilliant space of being like political satire, but also being like quite thoughtful. And I like went to bed and I was like, lying in bed, like trying to get to sleep, and in my head just sprang into my completely into my head. I was like, man, there's just such a great mega game scenario there. Mm-hmm. If you're not familiar with the film Death of Stalin, it's about the aforementioned death of Stalin. And when he passes away, he hasn't really left a particularly strong succession plan. So the Politburo kind of falls into this immediate period of scheming, which kind of leads to sort of like wider chaos within the Soviet regime. And the events in the movie do a great job of highlighting how like there's obviously very strong elements of direct power. Everybody understands that a general who can command soldiers and owns a gun is a powerful individual. But like, there's also elements of like how the transport ministry and like the workers and like the role of like the religious figures in the country all have this massive impact to play in like how the succession is viewed, what's going to happen next. Because the thing about a succession crisis is that you kind of lose it if you have to take it by force. Like, the ideal succession is that you accept the mantle and you step into it and the country can continue as before. If you have to take it by force, you suddenly get all this instability. And then, you know, it means that you're in a sort of revolutionary stage of government, which results in sort of having to deal with counter-revolutionaries. So yeah, I thought basically I was lying in bed and I was like, man, there's definitely something here. Thought about it some more when I got up the next day, and I was like, yeah, but there was some gross stuff in there too. If there's Beria, the head of the I think it's not the KGB, I think it's the NGV or something, or NKVD, just a terrible, terrible individual. Every scene he's in the movie is awful, and which makes him a great villain. But like, I was like, no, I don't think I want someone to play that. So yeah, I decided like, okay, well, how could we make this about something else? So I wrote up like a sort of fake country. The fake country had a very fake governing style, which is largely to facilitate gameplay, in all honesty. And going off of what you said about my transition from Rebel Country to Generalissimo, I was just convinced that like, do you know those sort of like amateur racing events where they take like a car and they just strip out like everything to make it as light as possible? I was convinced that's the way forward for mega games. I'm not sold on the idea of big complex ideas, because like I had like a sort of complex counterinsurgency game going on with multiple steps and ways to uncover intelligence and stuff. With Generalissimo, my goal was I just want people to have reasons to walk around and talk to each other. Anything you want to do, I want you have to do with a group of people, because nothing says conspiracy like planning together. And yeah, I just want all the core mechanics to reflect that, and I want everyone to be using similar enough in mechanics that everything can sort of interact together without having to, because I think a lot of mega games fall into this sort of like mode of you've just basically got four mini games or four smaller games, and it can be very difficult to decide when something if something is very on the border between too many games, it can be difficult to decide where it falls or how that impact travels from one table to the other. So I wanted to have like a sort of universal resolution system throughout. And I came up with the idea of using playing cards, also because I was like, you know, there's probably ways to keep costs down as well, because I bought a ludicrous number of Star Wars toys. I still have them all. I'm actually trying to sell some of them. But look, I bought all of Imperial Assault, all of Imperial Legion, most of Imperial Armada, a bunch of X-Wing stuff. So I was just because I got really obsessed with Star Wars when I was writing Rebel Country. So I kept justifying the cost of buying these things. The cost was never, ever reasonable. And it should never have been justified in my own mind, because I was like, there's no way this game will ever run enough to make the tickets back. Because I'd spent like £600 on Star Wars minis, which I've got a lot of use of since, but not in mega games.
Yeah, I was going to say, having dabbled very, very, very lightly in Star Wars, I think it was Armada. That sounds like a very expensive mega game. there's a lot of things I want to jump on there. But I guess the key thing is that simplifying the design process. That's really, I think that's the big conclusion that we've come to in the design community in Sydney about every time we design something, we just have to start stripping stuff out immediately, because it just starts getting convoluted and boiling down into just little board games that are happening around a big room. Obviously, that's overgeneralization, but it can happen. And I think we've been reminded of it recently when we've been doing some proactive marketing in Sydney, which is the first time we've actually had to do that. And a lot of the time we're targeting board game groups, and a lot of the time they don't get it. It takes quite a lot of explaining, especially if it's online via text, to get people who are really intrigued and into board games to understand what the Mega Game's all about, especially games like this one where the design process has deliberately stepped away from being like a clunky, rigid board game. And I think that shines through from a previous conversation we had. You mentioned how the original version of this had a map, like an operational game, and that's now gone. And I think what it's being replaced by is really elegant. But yeah, it's very clear that you've really peeled it back to the bare basics, and I think it works well. The other thing I was going to say, on the inspirations, the movie, The Death of Stalin, and some of the other inspirations as well are definitely satirical, but like they're also, I mean, The Death of Stalin's a comedy, which you know, sort of makes some of the serious tones of it much more palatable. And I feel like you managed to squeeze some of that comedy into the game as well. Reading through the rule book, the tone of it is very tongue-in-cheek and very sort of nodding to the audience about, you know, what it is that we're pretending exists here. Was that deliberate? Like, did you find when you started, were you trying to design a satirical piece, or did that come a bit later when you realized that it needs that layer on top?
No, I definitely wanted to do a satire from the start. I think the reason I liked it being satirical, and I think I'm drawn to that sort of concept in general, is that like I think you get to engage more in the entities that you're talking about in a sort of like writ large way. So like if you make a game about if you look at Watch the Skies, I think to an extent you get things like you put together the British team, and you put together an American team and a French team, and I think it's pretty common in a lot of the runs where the French team will show up and they'll all have mustaches and berets. The British team will probably bring tea. The British team will probably be overly polite a lot of the time, and the American team will be bombastic. I think those sort of like playing things larger than life allows you to sort of really explore how they're viewed. And I think that like, yeah, so generally Samoa, it is based on The Death of Stalin, but it is like, it's a larger piece about authoritarian regimes in general. There's a great book that I read called, what is it called? How to Become a Dictator? I should find the name of this for your references afterwards, but basically the whole thing is like your guide to becoming a fascist state or an autocratic state. And it talks about like all sorts of fascinating things that I didn't even realize about autocratic states. A big one being that the nature of how they run is that they actually have brilliant services, but the services are just very, very focused on keeping the state together and in power. So Iraq under Saddam Hussein had some of the best primary school education in the world. But that education stopped at about 14 because he needed very good workers. He just didn't want anybody getting college educated, or certainly not the vast majority of his populace getting college educated, because you end up with people asking questions. Similarly, a lot of the oil nations that are very autocratic, they have brilliant road services, provided that you're looking to drive from a port to a place that produces oil and back. If you were to try and drive to a place where people live, you would probably very quickly descend from A roads all the way down to Z roads, little dirt tracks. So yeah, I wanted to talk about like that sort of thing, and I wanted to talk about the sort of the idea of like everyone who's in power ends up having to have these sort of key holders, which are the people that you rely on to keep you in power. And I think that sort of like that sort of shines through in the mechanics of Generalissimo, because I think there's no real way for anyone to sort of unilaterally step into the shoes of the Generalissimo. A few people have tried some daring methods, but I think fundamentally you need the support of either the sort of like large body politic of the party, or you know, the iron fist of the secret police or the military, most likely to sort of step into it. So originally, whenever I was writing it, I had a big map, and I was planning a very sort of operational game, and I ended up writing all these mechanics for the movement of troops and like high like combat would play out and stuff. And I just, when I was done with it, I was just like, I wasn't happy with it, because I was like, on the one hand, it sort of semi feels like it makes sense that we have special rules for how combat's played out, because we sort of, from hundreds of other Mega games, have an idea of what, well, combat looks like. But they weren't good enough rules that I was happy with them. Like, they didn't show a lot of nuance, and there wasn't an awful lot of strategic choices. Like, having a better unit mattered a lot more than anything else. Mm-hmm. And I felt like, actually, these are just in here because I feel like they should be in here. And I basically made the decision that we're viewing the whole game from the point of view of a political lens. So everything should sort of be done through the apparatus of politics. And the assumption is that anyone making decisions that would result in the military action or like trying to launch a coup, it's done through sort of like, you don't know what's going to happen. If you give orders to a whole bunch of like captains in your elite paratrooper regiment, you're sort of just hoping that that plays out the way you think it will. There's not an awful lot of way, like the sort of roll the dice, I rolled a five, okay, that's why we lost that fight. That sort of feedback isn't actually available in any sort of combat scenario. So I decided I was happy enough with the sort of fuzzy logic of everything being sort of, what's the word?
Abstracted.
Yeah, abstracted out, rather than attempting simulation in a medium that I don't think necessarily always can do good simulation.
That was something I really liked once I got my head around the game, and knowing that there had originally been an operational game, because I guess without going into really granular detail, which we probably won't have time for, just quickly, the map game was essentially replaced by this game where people issue units orders, and those units are placed on a sliding scale of what they're up to basically each turn, and what they're up to will have effects on policy and on the state of the nation. But there's no moving around a map, there's no dice, there's no there's just units that, you know, assets that the state owns, and they're being given orders. And it's a little bit, you know, there's some complexities, but I really thought that was elegant. When you are playing this political game, it's all about coalition building. It's all about making deals. And then it would be very strange to have this war map happening and dice rolling. So well done on that.
I despise dice, so that was never going to happen. There was never really going to be dice.
I did want to ask one more thing just before we move on to... I know I want to... I think we need to dive into the details of the game for people. But just on the theme, finally... With it being, you know, if you remove the satire and you move some of the comedy of the inspiration, it can become quite a serious, like political, have some strong political messages. We haven't played the game in Sydney just yet. I think when this comes out, we may have not played it just yet either. We might, or it could be on the weekend when we play. So I haven't got the feedback from here about the game's theme yet. I'm wondering if, how players reacted to the theme when you first brought it to them. I think we've got different audiences in different parts of the world. And I'm wondering, you know, was this just part and parcel of the broader UK/European Mega Game theme scene? Or were people sort of like, oh, this sounds a bit borderline too serious for me? Or how did people take it?
Well, in Scotland, so I've only run it in Scotland. I'll get onto the online one, but in Scotland in person, which is obviously, it's easier to get a vibes feeling in a room of people. It very much was people leaning into the satirical element, I think, because like that sort of political satire. So like the country Eugenia's name is drawn from or based on a country from The Thick of It, which is written by it's Yesminster, but it's all sort of drawn from, like, there's this sort of like era of political satire that's all from the guy, very similar to the death of Stalin. And I think that there's a lot of people very happy to sort of play up. I think in the first couple of hours, there was an awful lot of people saying, like, you know, there was an awful lot of praise the Generalissimo. And and then every time someone said the Generalissimo's name, some people would salute. And so anytime the Generalissimo's name came up after his death was announced, there was a bunch of players that would take off their hats. it was fun to sort of act up. When we ran it online, we obviously had a broader set of players, because we ran it online twice, And I think one of the times we actually included, because obviously time zones are a big deal when you're trying to run things online. We did a run that like made it quite possible for, I think, up to the middle of the United States to be able to play. I don't think we could get the West Coast in, but they were all sort of like, so we had like a broad approach to things. The UK players definitely had a very, there's an underlying current of sort of dry wit. And they sort of like, it was a tongue-in-cheek seriousness, which definitely threw off some of the American players because they were leaning into the satire a bit more obviously. But also it did result in some players being just like a little confused by the theme. One person, I came up to me and they were like, where is Eugenia? And I was like, well, Eugenia's wherever Eugenia needs to be. Like it's a fictional state that could be anywhere. The main things are is it's autocratic and it's neighbors with Miranda and the US and China have interests in it. Like that's all the geopolitically, that's all the game needs. I think that the message, it's not like a strong one way or the other. It's really just about like how having a single authoritarian regime is somewhat of a house of cards. When that sort of breaks down, nobody really knows how the chips are going to fall. So the game has a sort of like, I think there's like three or four sort of narrative routes that are sort of expected within the policies that are likely to come out. Which is that the Generalissimo is dead, all hail the Generalissimo, let's live on with his legacy, and a traditionalist takes over and everything stays the same. The country is back under the secure thumb of the Generalissimo. On the other hand, there's a version where, you know, freedom starts to take over, there's like more workers' rights, the workers are allowed to sort of like children are allowed to go to high school again. And then there's just the version where the country sort of descends into absolutely revolutionary chaos, and there's like gunfire on the streets, and I think that the players sort of end up deciding themselves where they fall on that issue. Right. Usually the Ministry of Internal Security is strongly in favor of the traditionalists, and everyone else is sort of like pivoting according to their opinion of internal security.
Well, good to know. I'm keen to see how it's received here once we get some feedback to share with you.
Me too, honestly.
Absolutely. Awesome. I think we should dive into the mechanics of the game a little. Did you want to just start by talking about that central mechanic? I believe it revolves around playing cards, right?
So originally, I'll talk about what I had and then I'll talk about what I was going to do with it originally. So the core concept was there's four playing suits of cards. You've got hearts, diamonds, clubs, and spades. I wanted them to each represent a different thing within the nation, like a different sort of like nature of power. So hearts became like political will. How convincing you are in sort of getting your way within sort of political arenas and the sort of influences that you can wield across the various departments. Diamonds became capital, so your ability to finance things, your ability to make things happen with abstracted resource like money or promises. Spades was the workers, so workers as in just the sheer ability to get manpower and staff to do things. And then finally, clubs was enforcement. So basically, the ability to use coercion or force to get your way. And the reason the general idea when I came up with this was that I wanted to do, as I said, a single unifying mechanic. And initially, I was doing it with colored cards. These colored cards were sort of I think I just arbitrarily picked four colors, and I wanted to have the ability to, everyone got given cards at the start of their turn, and then there was a negotiation phase where people would sort of go around trading cards with one another to try and make sets. And my goal was that it would be like poker. Everyone would be trying to make poker sets, and different poker sets would do different things to try and like drive the game. In theory, I think that mechanic might work in a game. In testing for this game, though, did not work. mainly because apparently people just don't know poker hands. A lot of people were just like, I don't understand. I can't get. And I thought Poker Hands was a fairly ubiquitous sort of knowledge. I was like, two of a kind, three of a kind, four of a kind, but four of a kind beats to a full house, and that sort of stuff. It was when it was comparing Poker Hands is when people started to struggle. They were going to gather these Poker Hands out of colored cards, and then I realized, like, oh, I could just use regular playing cards, because I realized there was four main things I was looking for anyway. So I was looking at the four playing cards, and basically the idea came to me of rather than the players trading cards, which could take a lot of time and also result in you can have quite serious imbalances where, like, if 15 players all give their cards to one person, or like they really stack one person's hand, I was sort of worried that, you know, you sort of end up with a little bit of king making, or like it's not as cooperative. So the mechanic became there's basically these policies. Policies are dependent on two things. They need to be voted in using playing cards, and they need to be the state of the nation, which is essentially a graph showing you, I think it's like five national statistics, and these national statistics need to be in the right place for any sort of policy to pass. So if you're trying to pass a policy to get all the farmers arrested, you would need the country's repression to be very high, because if repression's not high, the country is not in a place to accept mass arrests. Similarly, like, you'd need if the legacy of the Generalissimo is very high, then people are feeling so emotionally attached to the previous time that they're unwilling to look at any changes. So there's a little bit of push and pull across the entire game to try and adjust these national statistics. Some of them affect the economy, some of them affect the ability for the military to move, some of them affect, like, whether or not political change can be made. So all the policies affect these sort of national statistics. And then each policy has, like, a sort of almost like a difficulty class of these are the things required to do it. So a policy might require like 12 political will and 3 manpower, which means it's something that whatever you're trying to do requires, it's a change that requires you to pull in favors across the state, but also it needs some workers to make it actually happen. So the players basically have to try and come together and play cards to make it happen. So all the cards are played face down. So you get this sort of like quite fun sort of everyone breaking off into little negotiations and saying like, oh, well, what can you play? What have you got? Because everyone's drawn different cards every round. So nobody's got like a set value. Someone might have drawn a really high card or a relatively low card. So you've always got that sort of like fresh need to talk to everyone in the party. And then obviously when you play your cards down, you don't have to have played the card you say you played. So also you get that sort of little bit of like underhandedness going on. So there's a little bit of chaos in there. And so that's sort of like back and forth. And then at the end of the turn, it's revealed which policies have passed and which ones have not. They're passed from left to right. So the leftmost policy happens first, which can be very important sometimes because it results in changes to the national statistics. So if you passed a policy that was going to tank repression, but you were hoping that didn't pass, but it did pass, your later policy that required repression to be high is going to be invalid, and it's not going to be it'll fail anyway. So there's a little bit of like scheming and like sometimes trying to stack the deck and sort of plan how things are going to go. And the policies themselves, there's only, I think it's 5 of them that get voted on every turn, might be 6. That's decided by the central committee. So the leadership of the Eugenian state, they sit for the first phase each turn and they decide what policies they would like to see coming in. And that can sometimes run counter to what the rest of the game wants. And they've all got their own sort of opinions about what should come and when. And so that's sort of like the soft leadership provided by the central committee is sort of like guiding. Yeah, but these are the policies we want to see. And then, of course, sometimes the players will bring in rogue policies themselves, which will have an increased impact elsewhere. And sometimes that impact will anger the central committee. But yeah, from a design perspective, the policies, they I think they make pretty clear sense from the perspective of bringing in political policy. But the other thing I wanted them to do was, because I wanted it to be a central mechanic and used for all resolution, I also decided to use the same rules, but for if a player wanted to try and do some sort of scheming, like trying to smuggle themselves out of the country, or bring in the CIA, or use the nation's gold to buy a bunch of mercenaries. Mm-hmm. So it uses the same mechanics as a policy. It's just not as... it doesn't go through the central committee. It doesn't get voted on in the same ways. And as a result, schemes are a little bit trickier, as in the difficulty, like the number of cards required to play them is a little bit trickier. And I like the sort of like the policies when they're being written up, I like to give them sort of like quite generic names so that people might know what's going on, but they might not. But yeah, so that sort of like guides that sort of like, I think it sort of creates this atmosphere of like, people know stuff, something is happening, but they might not necessarily know what is happening, which is great for like encouraging that sort of idea of just walking around the room and asking people, hey, do you know what's going on? It's just, have you heard about this? Which I think is like, I think that's intrinsic to what makes a mega game a mega game. I was going to say earlier, actually, yeah, when you were talking, Patrick, about the stripping rules out and stuff. I think I was listening to the episode about the survey that you guys did. The Mega Game, was it a survey? Poll?
Statistics? Rob survey.
Yeah, and I think Rob was talking about the idea of like how, although we have lots of board gamers, probably more board gamers than any other outside hobby, most people are not actually here for board gaming because they board game elsewhere. Like, it doesn't need to be board gaming. This is a different type of gaming, and I think that the social element is what makes mega games mega games.
I actually said exactly that to a friend of mine just before this podcast. I challenged myself to design a mini mega game, basically like a 3 hour or 2.5 hour game that could be used to sort of introduce people to mega gaming. And I won't go into it now. It's a mundane theme. And both the people that I was talking to were like, yeah, I don't know if the theme works. And I was like, I think the theme is there to capture people who like board games, but they're not going to come along and enjoy this because they like board games. I'm just hoping that because they like board games, they're also going to enjoy this, you know, like the parallels. Mm. But they're two different things, you know. And I think that's becoming more and more apparent. We're not playing board games as much as it helps sell, you know, well, maybe not sell, but articulate what a mega game is to say board game and you know, talk about maps and tokens and stuff. They really quite different horses in whatever race where
and even board games don't seem to know what they are. Well, I say don't seem to know, that's silly. There's no centralized board game, but what board games are has expanded so much, like Blood on the Clock Tower becoming this like crazy runaway success, despite having like very little in, like, there's nothing in familiar from Blood on the Clock Tower in Monopoly.
The DNA's changed quite a bit. Before I jump in to the teams, I was keen to just sort of articulate some of the extra points that you haven't covered yet about the different functions of the game. But just talking about that gameplay loop, one thing that I've quite enjoyed reading through it, not having run it yet, but reading through, I feel like you and I have had some conversations since I bought the game about sort of producing... a theme of bureaucracy and how government operates and stuff through the game. And I found it really interesting how the turns are about 50 minutes long. And what you were talking about earlier about the central committee coming together and talking about what policies are going to proceed, that's about half an hour. So that's more than half of the turn. Then the voting happens after that, the voting of how, whether people are going to pass these policies or not. And then right at the end, there's this little 5 minute slot, which is when the committee members formally go and talk to, you know, the teams that they represent at the committee. And that's kind of like the only time formally on the agenda of the game phase, like the phases, the turn phases, that those players can kind of say to the committee member, hey, we really want these policies to pass next turn. So everything's kind of happening in a vacuum. I found that really interesting and really clever because it's disconnecting the policymakers to the people who are doing the work in the sort of bureaucracy and the sort of coming up with the long-term schemes.
I've worked in government and I still work in government. And I think a lot of people in Mega Games actually do some sort of public sector stuff. And I think that the type of leadership we receive is roughly in line with that.
Totally agree. And I mean, that's why I locked onto that and found it so intriguing because it's very true to life for my real life work as well. So you've covered quite a bit talking about the playing cards and that centralized kind of mechanic that runs throughout the game. Central committee, you've spoken about quite a bit, but I thought maybe we could just dive into the teams as well. Each of them is kind of representing this core government agency or ministry of the country. So there's the treasury, there is the economic development department, there is the communications department that does the programming for TV channels and that kind of thing, propaganda basically. Don't need to sort of run through every single one of them, but did you want to talk through the sort of side games that you've designed for the game that each of those teams is sort of dealing with alongside all this politicking?
Yeah, so obviously I said I wanted a single unified mechanic, but I didn't manage a single unified mechanic. There's definitely other mechanics in there. Obviously I've talked a little bit about the Central Committee. Their job is to sort of provide a sort of, and as you said, it's almost a hands-off leadership. In some games, I think there was entire departments that were like not sure who their Central Committee member was because they'd seen them so rarely. So the Central Committee is basically in charge of a bunch of government ministries. And the idea of these government ministries was to sort of capture the various important parts of the state. And then when I started designing this, the first thing I did was look up how many departments does the UK government have? The answer is a nonsense number. It's like 193. I was like, and I was reading through them and I was like, I have no idea what some of these departments do. And I work in government. I thought like I'd have like a better than average civic knowledge. I was blown away by how like intricate and detailed some little agencies are. So I distilled it down to a few basic ministries. And when I was done, realized I still missed out on some big things because running a country is an immensely complicated process. a big one is obviously internal security. So they're the secret police. And I think that team is a very big team because I think that team sort of sells the theme in a big way. The sort of the era of Stalinistic terror was driven by that sort of fear of the NKVD. So the Ministry of Security do that. They have some units, so they can deploy units, as we talk about, on that tracker. So they sort of can affect the state that way. They also have a prison full of a gulag for all intents and purposes of missing people. Those missing people are some of them are wanted by other committee members or other party members. So other players are looking to get like such and such that they know is freed. But they also just have a whole bunch of people that were just genuinely either, you know, good members of society or bad members of society. And they can sort of just release those and it will start causing chaos to the country. Or they can decide to be, no, we know where this one is. We've properly reprocessed this person. We're going to decide if we are going to let them out. So it sort of gives them a sort of hand of bargaining chips. And then the other thing that the secret police have access to is they have a Supreme Court justice who's, their role is to sort of rule on court cases that come through, and these court cases could also have an impact. So there's basically one court case a turn that may affect the overall standing of the nation, and the types of decisions that they might make might be affected by the sort of wider political situation. Then we've got sort of a couple of departments that were sort of designed to be quite stable. They mainly interact with the main mechanic of the game, so they're designed to sort of be like the sort of the work department. So like the economic development and the foreign ministry, and I think the treasury and transport, like most of the departments, the idea was every action a player can take, which is the playing cards to sort of to affect policies, can have a very outsized impact in the game. So I didn't want it to be about doing lots of little mini games, but I did make a couple of mini games for certain departments. So I think the Ministry of Communications, they have to arrange a television schedule every turn. The television schedule has a bunch of, just various sort of autocratic television programs, nice. which basically will influence how the country feels. An important one is that they need to put on it's the equivalent of EastEnders or Neighbours, but they need to put that in every day. And if they don't put that in every day, the nation's stability will drop.
Yep.
So they need to find time for that. And there's a couple other ones certain TV shows will promote like a sort of American agenda. Certain TV shows will promote a Chinese agenda so that they affect the sort of corporations as well. So the Ministry of Communications is sort of involved in all that. And then, yeah, there's the, what do you call it? There's also some mechanics around the key factor of a lot of autocratic nations is they have one thing that they export that other people want, and that's what keeps them. That's what usually the difference between a successful autocratic nation and a failed autocratic nation is, whether or not they have something they can export. So that's why there's an awful lot of oil nations. And similarly, you'll see like diamond nations. In the case of Eugenia, it's the very vaguely named rare earth minerals. These rare earth minerals are vital to the economy of Eugenia, and so the foreign ministry, the economic ministry, and the transport ministry are all involved with the extraction of these minerals and getting them to a port to be sold to the corporations. And they also, there's a little bit of like bidding and sort of jostling with the various corporate entities to decide like how much, or to decide how to fund the country. With these materials, I guess the Revolutionary Guard headquarters, the military, their job is to guard the rare earth mineral mines, because they're the neighboring nation of Buranda might try and steal them. That's like sort of like a running theme throughout it. And then finally, there is the two corporations, and the two corporations sort of are designed to represent external influences. So the ubiquitous global economy that is American corporations. A lot of developing countries have like quite close ties with Beijing and China, particularly on like an economic level. Both of those, the Beijing company and the American company are basically designed to sort of be quite, they're competing against each other more than anything else. They're just using Eugenia as a sort of like a playing piece in this, whilst both of them are trying to acquire as much rare earth minerals, because that's one of the sort of like key geopolitical resources that we have at the moment. The corporations have their own sort of little game that's to do with gathering and spending of resources that they basically purchase off of the Eugenian government. And as well as that, they have their own way that they interact with the wider card game, in the sense that the Joker cards are entirely coming in from the corporations, and the Joker cards act as sort of like not quite wild cards, kind of like if a wild card's job was mostly to just sink your hand in poker, they sort of are, they're like a spanner that can be thrown in the works of other people's policies. I think there was a very memorable one in the Edinburgh run where somebody actually managed to convince enough people and a committee member to put in a vote for me, I should become the Generalissimo. So it became like an official policy that we could consider this person for the Generalissimo. And they had a big stack of cards, like a lot of people had put cards in, and people were starting to think like, oh, are we about to see the Generalissimo? And then when they revealed, there was 9 different jokers in there, and each joker counts against the policy being passed. So it basically obliterated it down, like the vote down to like, they almost had like 2 votes at the end, because so many people had played against them getting in. So they were completely undermined, and they were notably all from the American Joker. So they were all, it was implied to be some serious CIA shenanigans had gone on, right. Nice. To stop this person who may have been a legitimate heir to the Generalissimo. Caused something of an outrage. I think the American corporation was chased out of the country after that, actually. So those are the 3 main sort of sections of the game. I think I've talked about the majority of the mini games. Yep. Don't know if I've missed any.
Nice.
Yeah, and I like the design of them. A lot of them are very simple, but require a bit of time. So they're clearly there to give everyone a little bit of, you know, something unique that they control, but also something that takes them as a team away from all the politicking just for a little bit to you know, to raise the stakes and the pressure.
They represent us that we all have day jobs. Day jobs right. That our leaders don't know about.
You mentioned this in the previous chat we had, the coups and execution side of things. I'm really interested in this one because, yeah, death in mega games is something we've chatted about a lot on this podcast. So I'm really curious how you handle that, those mechanics and, things that can be a bit, controversial or can lead to kind of a negative experience.
So I feel my hands were tied by theme. So I totally agree with the general stance that the mega game community has, which is that death in mega games is difficult and maybe should just be avoided. And I totally generally agree. But thematically, I think sometimes you can't avoid it.
Absolutely agree, yeah. Mm.
So I tried to make it as fair as I could. The idea was that if somebody's getting arrested / executed / whatever, it works a little bit differently from a regular policy in the sense that there is a policy that gets voted through and that sort of allows such a person to become arrested / executed or whatever. Kind of like everyone, it's assumed that being part of the political party of the state of Eugenia, that gives you the sort of political armor that you have, that you can sort of act with impunity until someone strips away that armor, and then now you're vulnerable. But once you're vulnerable, it's not the end for you. You get to then play out, and then basically it's a slightly different mechanic, and this is where I got in my poker hands. The two sides get to basically play a poker hand of cards, 5 cards against each other. Mm. Which means that if you're very popular, both, you know, in the room and also in the party, you could try and just like drum up a bunch of high level players and be like, yeah, okay, I know that you probably have got a bunch of kings and aces sitting in your hand. Let's just get these together and let's make an ironclad I can't be arrested scenario. And similarly, if you're trying to arrest somebody, you similarly are going to try and gather your allies. I wanted it to be like poker hands because I think that if you give it that 5 card limit and you're trying to optimize the best you can do within that 5 card limit, I think that's a more interesting design space than purely piling on numbers, because piling on numbers does just make it almost like a popular vote, which is not what I wanted it to be. I wanted it to feel like a scheme, someone had cleverly pulled a conspiracy against you. And if you've seen The Death of Stalin, like whenever a character is killed, it's a conspiracy that has been drawn together to sort of create this moment. So I think in terms of the arrest mechanics, I think they've only been used once in Edinburgh. The player that played the regular police had a real vendetta with the secret police. And the player who played the regular police, his son was supposed to play on his team, but his son got sick that day and wasn't able to come. So he was there as the only member of his ministry by his lonesome. And the secret police team has 6 players. They got really annoyed because he just kept getting under their feet, because he's quite a clever player and he was quite like disruptive to their goals and he was good at negotiating. So he really pulled a lot of levers to sort of like throw the internal security ministry under the bus. So they got to the point where they're like, we just gotta fucking get rid of this guy. This guy needs to go. So they go and they pass this law, and the law is not that difficult to pass for them because there's 6 of them. They can get a lot of, they can play a lot of clubs cards between them, and enforcement is largely what's required to bring down a thing, although they needed some political will as well. They pull in some foreign ministry allies there. But yeah, so they get that passed, and I'm like, okay, so now you need to prepare a poker hand, you need to put... And once the policy is passed, I just tell everyone, like, this is what's happening. This card, this arrest attempt is going to stay open until the end of the next turn. So you have some time to go and find allies and sort of like, and so they started this mad dash. The guy that was playing the regular police was able to pull together like 3 members of the central committee. He pitched it as the secret police are trying to overthrow the entire country. Like, look at this. They're undermining the very basis of justice. And because of the way that the central committee had been sort of debating, the their head of like sort of internal security had annoyed some people and had stood on some toes. And so the Central Committee very much became like, we need to stand up for what is right. This guy needs to get his fair share. So he had a brilliant hand of cards. Whereas the internal security, they were very sort of like, they were very cocky and confident. They were like, yeah, we'll be able to get this guy. So they played like an okay set of cards, but they didn't realize just how much of the Central Committee had stopped them. So he did get to keep his job and he didn't die. Later on, some other players were executed and we did deal with, I say executed, I think some of them fled the country, but we dealt with a few recastings. So as I said, like we knew some people were going to die in the nature of the story of the death of Stalin. So basically I prepped a whole bunch of briefings that are designed to be sort of stepped into mid game. Some of them are quite satirical. Some of them are quite serious. The general rule that we've come up with from doing this a few times is that if you step into a role, you shouldn't be stepping into a role that can take advantage of the role that you were previously in, because you might have knowledge that you shouldn't really have, but also that your new role doesn't completely undermine your original role, because you don't want to just like, just sort of try and counteract the things you've been doing earlier that day. So yeah, for the ones that are predictably possibly going to die. So I think there's a very real possibility of the military getting overthrown. There's a very real possibility of the head of the internal security being overthrown. Those ones I wrote specifically like who they should become. They have like a successor player that it's expected that they may become. Then I wrote some generic dead accounts that are basically, if anybody else just died or disappeared, they can become this. And they all sort of include sort of various little, they've got their own sort of like play arc or like basically a sort of, the idea was to give them a narrative brief that won't take a full day to play out. It's imperfect. I think that no matter what, it sucks a little bit to lose your character. But I don't think it completely derails the experience, that's the key. I think one player, they were having a very stressful start of the day. They were playing as one of the generals of the military, and they were they went in a little hoorah, and then found that at like turn two and three that the political apparatus of the country had not appreciated their gung-ho attitude, and they felt very beleaguered, and they were like, I think they just like, hey, I'd like to change role. Can I leave the country? Or I think they literally fled the country via the corporations. But anyway, long story short, they ended up in a new role and they had a much better time. So mechanically, it still sort of worked. But yeah, so it's a sticky issue, and I haven't listened to that episode of the podcast yet. So I haven't decided where I fall on it yet. Yeah. But it's hard to avoid in some themes for sure.
Yeah.
I think there's so many stories that can come out when, you know, death or being arrested or being kidnapped, when these things are on the table, that, yeah, it's not a solved issue yet, but yeah, I can't, I think death is still something that I really want to keep seeing in mega games, if just to see see what we can do with it, basically.
And I think that, you found a good middle ground in the idea of having succession for some people. So it's not a random bit of paper that was randomly generated, and it could, like you said, totally counteract everything that they've done all day. Or, you know, worst examples I've heard of, for example, were players who are given a brief that's basically like, well, now you're anti your whole team and all the planning that you did before the game and everything you've done in the game so far, you need to go and sort of undermine it now. And that's not fun for most people. Someone out there probably loves that idea, but
there's probably a select type of player that really enjoys that concept. Most people will
that
not.
That player's going to do it anyway, so they don't need a point. but I think the fact that you put some thought into the succession briefs is really good. And also, just in general, the briefings for this game, the role briefings, they're very succinct and brief, but they're all unique as well. Like, it's a very role-driven game. Nobody is just the leader of the US, and that is the generic title, but everyone's got a little bit of quirk to them. So I think, yeah, I'm interested to see how it plays out here in our runs, because I feel like you have found a bit of a middle ground that most people should be okay with. The other thing being that in your original material, and also again in what we're using here to sell the game, and in the rulebook that we're going to be using, it's made really clear that that kind of stuff is part of the game, and it's going to happen probably, and people should sort of respect it and be faithful to it as part of the game. And I think that helps a lot.
Yeah, I think, like, I mean, to be fair, we come to that version from three runs. I think the first run, some of the deaths were handled quite clumsily. I had backup briefings, but they were much more akin to the random ones. And so I think we had at least one player that died, and they were having a great day up until they died. And then they were like a bit deflated after that. And they didn't die at the start of the game, which was good. So they got like five good turns, and then they missed out on the finale. And so, yeah, lessons were learned as part of the process,
yeah,
for sure.
Which is why I think the game's in the state that it is now. So it's a clear learning and redevelopment process, and I think it's in a really good state now. So it shows.
Fingers crossed.
So, speaking of lessons learned, what would you say, after having run it online and in person quite a few times now, what would you say is the biggest thing you've learned out of it all, or about designing mega games, or just in general?
So I think, like, I'm happy with the philosophical choice I made going into it, that I think that the game is fundamentally about moving around and talking to each other more than anything else. So I think, like, and I think we talked about this a little last time when we were chatting about the game, and then it came up again on the survey episode. Yeah, I think that more and more there's a movement within mega games that, like, the game does not need to be particularly crunchy and deep to still have a very deep experience, because I think the deep experience is in the player-to-player stuff. It's that sort of, like, operating within an imperfect information environment is, I think that provides enough chaos. So I think that part of it I'm very happy with. In terms of, like, running it online versus in person, I think that in person there's a charm to it that's just impossible to replicate online. I think that the game mechanically actually probably runs smoother online, because the voting is a little bit more simplistic online, just because it's hard to do a card draw with every player online, so the mechanics are a little bit the negotiations are a little bit more stable, so you end up with some very interesting power dynamics in the online one, almost like political parties forming within the party. Factionalism starts to break out much more, whereas in the in-person game, everyone is drawing cards, so an individual's voting power goes up or down according to their turn, which I think is, it's good in its own way, because it represents the sort of idea of, like, ebb and flow of, like, your ability to influence your surroundings, but it results in, like, everything becomes a lot more dynamic, which is easier to do in person, I guess, as well. So yeah, I think those are my main two sort of, like, takeaways of running it so far.
And then you've packaged up the game, and it is available for people who are listening to this episode and are keen to check it out or run it themselves. What would you say, if you do you have any advice to people who are keen to run it, or a big thing they should keep in mind that isn't immediately obvious, or also, what would you say is your tip to people who are keen to package up their own mega games?
So initially, I wouldn't have had an answer to that first part, because Patrick hadn't asked all his questions yet about the things that were not immediately obvious, because to me, they're immediately obvious. So yeah, classic problem of the author reading it. And then, like, I did have people read over it, but I guess, like, it's very different to read over it with, this makes sense, to, oh, I'm actually trying to run this. That's a very different process of reading, because you actually want a much better understanding. So I appreciate all of Patrick's questions. They've been really good. I think I tried to lay out my key thoughts in, like, a control handbook, because I feel like a control handbook is like invaluable when creating a game to like capture some ideas like editorial intent. Yeah, that sort of idea of like what I'm expecting the game to be. I outlined my strong opinion on dice and how nobody should be bringing a D6 to decide anything in my game. And I think that, yeah, if you were running Generalissimo, I think the key thing is to just sort of embrace that it is, it's a lighthearted satire, just sort of dressed up in a sort of like boogeyman suit. It looks serious and dark. I think, yeah, you mentioned previously Papers, Please. It's very Papers, Please. It's it's tongue in cheek. It's meant to be, it's meant to be silly, but like not silly in a wacky way. It's meant to be a country that's just a little too ridiculous to exist. And I think that, yeah, I think that's important to like sort of bear in mind, to sort of make the game, flow in a fun and engaging way. In terms of like how to publish a game, I'm sure I would have had more thoughts if I'd made it to your previous episode of the podcast.
But you were at the pub.
Yeah, I got the day wrong. I thought it was a Saturday. I'd say that the key things I have learned from this process are, yeah, I think you can't make things clear enough in your like materials to explain to someone else, because whoever's coming along and reading your materials, they don't have the insight of why you did ever anything or what you were thinking when you did it. So I think that explain where everything comes from. I think it can just be like an appendices to your control thing. Cause like what I tried to do in the end was include like, here's roughly how I consider the math to work in terms of the game balance. Like, here's what I think about the various sort of, if you're making a policy, this is what it should look like and why. And here's sort of like the sort of numbers that are doable and which numbers are not. Because I think that sort of like it helps, because ultimately I think almost everyone running a mega game is probably at least amateur or enthusiastic game designer themselves, because you have to be a bit of a game designer to want to run mega games, frankly. I don't think anyone's running them purely as a maybe just Chris from Very Large Games. He seems to be entirely happy being a facilitator.
He gets mentioned.
He's truly an anomaly. Yeah. I think that the majority of people running mega games have some degree of design in their mind. So I think like helping fellow designers get an idea of what's going on, I think is invaluable.
Yeah, I think, as someone who's reading other people's games now more and more, I'm learning that more and more from my own learnings, that no matter how much it all makes sense to you, you need to somehow remove your own knowledge and context from the review. Otherwise, you're going to end up with this stuff that just, it means it doesn't make sense to people. They're missing the why. I think that in the version that you know, that I got off the bat, you had done a really good job in the control stuff, because like you said, there was guidance there already that said, you know, when people are creating new policies, here's a list of things that you should, you know, work within. So if they're doing X, then it should be worth Y, the policy cost, for example. That stuff isn't always available in these games. And I think that a lot of people, they struggle to get the design done. And then on the day, there's one dude running around, which I think everyone here has been that person, who is just making discretionary calls on things. And putting it on paper is a huge step forward. So props on that. You have run many games in the past. It sounds like this was your formal sort of second design after the Watch the Skies period. What are you working on now? Is there anything that you can tell us about?
So I've got a couple of things in the works. I'm wanting to do a mini version of Rebel Country, because there's a local game shop that was talking about like running sort of evening games. And I was like, you know what? Actually, I think a sort of little 3-hour mega game experience could maybe be worth it. And I've got all the stuff for Rebel Country, and I would like to sort of redevelop it to be simpler. Well, ultimately, that's the main goal, is to just simplify it right down. Because you could strip out all that sort of complexity that I included the first time. And then I'm writing a D&D game called Heroes and Heralds, mostly because I like the idea of a D&D mega game, because I've played a few fantasy mega games, and I think that all fantasy mega games that I've played have very much they take the stance of very sort of like a Game of Thrones. We're all very large, powerful entities interacting with each other in a sort of like a very sort of political and war is just politics by other means sort of way. Whereas I want this game to be about I want it to be D&D in the sense that I want there to be adventurers, and I want the players to play adventurers. I want people to be like, I'm Gorf the Barbarian. I'm coming to meet you, High King Wenceslas. Tell me what you need, bud. I'm Gorf. I'll sort it out for you. So I'm trying to sort of capture that idea of like the two levels of like the kingdom stuff should feel like you're a powerful king. And you should be able to do lots of things, but certain things you just need a bunch of grimy adventurers willing to crawl through dark holes and seize treasure from dragons. That's my hope for Heroes and Heralds. I haven't quite worked out all of the details of it yet, but it's the design is coming along. I'm hoping to have something ready for next year.
Both of those very appealing. I'm really keen to hear more about Rebel Country. As soon as you brought that up in the original conversation we had, and then started drawing those correlations between Andor as being this modern new lens to look at it through, I'm 100% sold. So if you need anyone to look at any of the rules as that comes along, bring it on.
Absolutely.
Kieran, thanks again for joining us and having us chatting to us a second time about this game. If people want to reach out to you, if they want to buy the game, The Generalissimo is Dead, or if they want to get in touch with you or the community at True North, how can they do that?
Well, the community at True North is, we're mostly on Discord. We have an Instagram as well, but it's True North Games. Mm-hmm. True North Mega Games? God, what are we called? Mega Games, not just regular games. No. True North Mega Games. And then I am operating under the brand of Son of One Eye, which is just a pun on my surname. So I have an itch store, and that's where I'm selling Generalissimo. I also have an Instagram, which I'm not very good at I'm not very good at engagement. I need to get better at like regular posts, but it's because I'm not currently running any games at the moment, so I've been a little bit lax. So yeah, feel free to reach out to me. I also have an email address at megagames@dundee. I don't even know my email. Just reach me on Instagram or Discord. I'll be easy enough to find him in a bunch of the Mega Game Discords. And I'm very happy to sort of like chat with people and discuss. I've had a few people email me from the itch page, just asking questions about Generalissimo and stuff. So yeah, I'm happy to help out with people running Mega Games, because it's just a great community to be part of. And then, yeah, those are the easiest ways to get in touch with me if you don't find me in person.
Awesome. Well, thank you again. We will have links to all of those different communities and ways to reach you in the notes. And look forward to talking to you about more Wiki Games in the future. And look forward to giving you some feedback from Sydney.
I'm very excited.
Thanks again, Kieran.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, guys.